From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Philip Lopate has nothing against pleasure, but he has a distaste for the smug, upbeat, flaunting style of enjoyment. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Lopate about his new collection of essays, Against Joie de Vivre. Also today, what do you really want from your bathroom and your kitchen? Architect and writer Witold Rybczynski tells us how he answered those questions when he built his own home. Critic at Large Laurie Stone reviews a new show about a taboo subject by New York performance artist Holly Hughes. And pianist Harry Connick Jr. joins us in our weekly performance spot. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. When Philip Lopate was asked to write an essay for an anthology about the Old Testament, he wrote about growing up in the era of biblical movie epics, which led him to reflect on the influence of the Samson and Delilah story on his love life. Lopate writes personal essays, many of them are quite funny, in which he wrestles with intellectual confusion and ambivalent feelings. His collection Bachelorhood, Tales of the Metropolis, has just been reprinted. And he has a new collection called Against Joie de Vivre. The title essay is about his distaste for people who make a spectacle of their hearty enjoyment of life. His other essays are about the problems of living upstairs from your landlord, shaving off your beard and seeing your face for the first time in years, how moviegoing can become a substitute for living, and the suicide of a colleague. Lopate is also the author of the novel The Rug Merchant. He's on the selection committee of the New York Film Festival and teaches at Columbia University's graduate writing program. I asked Philip Lopate to explain joie de vivre and why he hates it.
Well, joie de vivre is French expression for the joy of life. And I'm not sure that I do hate it, but I wrote this essay against joie de vivre partly because there's something perverse in me which likes to explore minority opinions or opinions that are different from the usual. And it seems to me that everybody's running around trying to be so happy and to take pleasure, and so what would happen if I had a kind of anti-hedonistic position and ran with it as far as I could. And essentially I have nothing against joie de vivre, but I have a lot against a kind of desperate pleasure hunting which denies the amount of sadness and sorrow that is inevitably in the world, or at least it seems to me that way.
As an example of what you mean, let me ask you to read a passage from your essay Against Joie de Vivre.
Okay. Ah, what a twinkle in the eye the old man has. He'll outlive us all. So we speak of old people who bore us when we wish to honor them. We often see projected onto old people this worship of the life force. It is not the fault of the old if they then turn around and try to exploit our misguided amazement at their longevity as though it were a personal tour de force. The elderly, when they are honest with themselves, realize that they have done nothing particularly to be proud of in lasting to a ripe old age and then carrying themselves through 1,000 more days. Yet you still hear an old woman or man telling a bus driver with a chuckle, "Would you believe that I am 84 years old?" as though they should be patted on the back for still knowing how to talk, or as though they had pulled a practical joke on the other riders by staying so spry and mobile. Such insecure, wheedling behavior always embarrasses me. I will look away rather than meet the speaker's eyes and be forced to lie with a smile, "Yes, you are remarkable," which seems condescending on my part and humiliating to us both. Like children forced to play the cute part adults expect of them, some old people must get confused, trying to adapt to a social role of indeterminate standards, which is why they seem to whine, "I'm doing all right, aren't I, for my age?" It is interesting that society's two most powerless groups, children and the elderly, have both been made into sentimental symbols. In the child's little hungry hands grasping for life, joined to the old person's frail, slipping fingers hanging on to it, you have one of the commonest advertising metaphors for intense appreciation. It is enough to show a young child sleeping in his or her grandparents' lap to procure joie de vivre overload.
When you express cynicism about sentimental symbols,
yes,
Do friends get really irritated with you and think that you're a grouch or a killjoy, or that you're incapable of feeling certain obvious human emotions?
Sometimes they get very irritated at me. The thing is that I don't really think of myself as a consistent curmudgeon. It's a pose I take in order to explore some material. It's a voice, in a way. As you know from having read the book, there's a wide range of attitudes and postures in the book, and sometimes I think it's very life-embracing, and sometimes it's comic, and sometimes it's sad. But I think that if people get annoyed at me for being a curmudgeon, then I have to accept that, since in part I'm writing this way to provoke them, just to sort of overturn some of the common ideas. For instance, I love old people and I love children, but I don't like the manipulation of the sentimentality involved with them.
Mm-hmm. You write that you associate certain joie de vivre rituals with depression. Would you explain that?
I started seeing a lot in the 70s, the me decade era, people taking care of themselves more and more, and becoming obsessed with physical fitness and the food they put into their system. And often when I was around them, I would get a kind of a sense of sadness coming underneath it, and it often seemed to me that if only they would just be sad, then we could both get beyond it. But because they were running away from some kind of interior pain so much and denying it, then the whole thing smacked of depression to me. I'm not saying that everybody, is depressed. I'm saying that the whole phenomenon of personal self-actualization and all the sort of psychobabble does seem to me to have a tonality which is close to warding off depression.
Do you ever find yourself getting depressed when you're around somebody who's really happy, because happiness doesn't come that easy to you?
What a personal question, and a good one. I would say that what bothers me more is feeling that somebody is unhappy, and that I've got to put up with the false mask of everything being okay. This is a funny thing to say, but sometimes when you'll have a friend, and the friend will be very manic and a little hysterical, and then sometimes you'll see her or him in a bad moment in their life, and they'll become much more appealing. You feel like you have access to them in a way.
I know what you mean, but sometimes you wonder if that's because of your own insecurity, that you appreciate other people's weaknesses and understand them so well.
Thank you, Terry. I needed that.
No, I mean, I didn't mean you personally. I meant that was a we.
Yeah. A you and a we. A lot of what I'm trying to do in the personal essay form is to play with the idea of you, I, and we.
You mean of getting to the we through the I?
Getting to the we through the I. I think that I'm trying to create a singular, somewhat idiosyncratic I, a first person, who won't claim to be we all the time. Sometimes when I read lifestyle articles in magazines, I'm insulted because they say we are like this and we do this, and I think, hey, maybe you Buster, but not me. So what I'm trying to do is to sort of create a kind of singular persona, and say, listen, you may disagree with me, this may grab you the wrong way, or you may really love it, but in any case, you are not I. And then underneath that is the larger promise that because each of us is alone and singular, there is a kind of universal experience that we do share.
My guest is writer Philip Lopate, and his new book is a collection of essays called Against Joie de Vivre. Now, one of the essays in the new book is about the personal essay.
Right.
And I wonder how you started writing this kind of essay, and if you distrust big themes, or if you would distrust yourself writing about big themes.
Well, I've got essays on suicide, on friendship, on city life, sexuality. What's your idea of a big theme that I'm distrusting?
Well, that's a good point. but they're all kind of in the details of daily life.
Oh yeah.
The way you write about them, you're not writing like the last word on suicide.
No.
I mean, you're writing about your personal attempt at it when you were 17.
Yes, or the teacher, the school teacher who I worked with.
Exactly, jumping out a window. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, like perhaps it is a modesty, a sense of what I've experienced, I know, and I can't make claims for everyone. But it's also a love of daily life. I think my whole position, all of my books, are very non-apocalyptic. You know, I keep seeing the world as going on and surviving. I'm not interested in huge conflagrations, however you pronounce that word. I got interested in the personal essay after having written a few books, actually. When I was a kid going to high school and college, and people told me to write essays and compositions, I hated it. You know, it was a form that suggested schoolwork, I suppose, and doing a theme. And I guess I was taught essay writing the wrong way. You know, sort of take a position. Are you for or against capital punishment? And what happened was that I began to read some of the great essayists like Montaigne and Lamb and Hazlitt, and I saw that an essay could be a wonderful way to move from idea to idea without necessarily, you didn't have to sort of hammer one point home. In fact, you could contradict yourself. An essay could track your thoughts. It could be a conversation with the reader and a conversation with yourself. And so in a way, it was much more freeing to me than, let's say, the contemporary short story, which has to be very compressed, where you can't have any details that are inessential, and where usually you move toward a kind of epiphany. So I wanted to get out of that straitjacket of the short story. And I've written a few novels, but what's hard to do in novels is just to tell readers what you think, because you always have to do it behind characters and behind a drama. So this was a way for me to open my own voice and put it on the page.
Now, your previous book of personal essays, Bachelorhood, had several essays about being single. Are you still single?
I am still single, but I have a girlfriend. She'll be happy that I said that on the air.
Are you shy about saying that? Or does this make it more official to acknowledge it on the air?
Well, it is official. It's funny because my writing in many ways is so personal and I confess so many things. And yet, in another sense, I still feel fairly private about my private life.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to reconcile that except to say that I create a persona, Philip Lopate, on the page, and he tells things, mainly about the past.
Exactly, things that are kind of at a safe distance and have been resolved?
Yes, and if, when someone starts to ask me about my life right now, I definitely want to protect it somewhat.
Well, I always think that the present is never in focus as clearly as the past is.
Definitely. Now, this whole idea of being single, when I wrote about it in Bachelorhood, and in fact I carry it on in the Genshua Deriva a little, has to do with a kind of a detached perspective and the role of this sort of roving anthropologist who sort of, you know, looks in on people's lives and doesn't allow himself to be pinned down. And I was really creating a kind of character, a bacheloric character who was very suitable to me in the same way, let's say, that Buster Keaton created a Buster Keaton character. Buster Keaton didn't really fall over himself or do the things he did, you know, in real life. So this is somebody who is who both is me and is not me, in a sense.
Well, that being said, I was wondering if you distrust marriage at all. You've been married once.
I'm a great fan of marriage for other people. like most bachelors, I'm very sentimental about marriage. So I have absolutely nothing ideologically against marriage. You know, I don't think that there's anything wrong with it. I think that I would like to get married again. This is the kind of thing that I say, and then when you watch my behavior, it doesn't always jibe exactly, you know. I don't know. I must associate being a writer with having my own space, being alone, being able to control things in that way. so that if I did or do get married again, I'll have to figure out a way to protect that notion of myself. I think some men or women who are married continue to give off vibes that are very much like bachelors, you know.
Are you the kind of writer who really needs to be not only in a room by yourself, but in an apartment by yourself in order to really figure out what you think?
That's true. That's it. Yes, exactly.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your writing, your persona, and your real life, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is writer Philip Lopate, and his new book is a collection of personal essays called Against Joie de Vivre. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is writer Philip Lopate, and his previous books include a collection of essays called Bachelorhood and the novel The Rug Merchant. Well, we were just talking about marriage, pro and con. And I was wondering if you did get married again, what kind of ceremony you'd want to have? Because you have a very funny essay about how much you dislike it when people write their own ceremony, write their own vows.
Yes, I wrote this essay called Revisionist Nuptials because I kept getting invited to these weddings where people were rewriting the ceremonies and reading poems or putting them in strange places or making large marriage vows, which seemed very pretentious to me. I think I would probably go to City Hall or something like that, be the lamb led to the slaughter instead of trying to control the whole thing.
In one of your essays, you write about this lifelong desire to be the hero in your own life story. And I think writing personal essays probably helps to fulfill fulfill that ambition.
Or the villain, let's say.
Right, right. But I was wondering if that desire to be the hero in your life story came from being so absorbed in books and films when you were coming of age.
The reference to being the hero in my own life story connected with a book I had written, Being with Children. And in that book, I was working with kids, teaching them poetry, filmmaking, theater, all kinds of creative subjects. And I was, quote, doing good, unquote. I felt that I was fulfilling some elevated function. And it was the only time in my life when I actually felt that I was in any sense being a hero, you know. And since then I've occasionally had cravings to go off to Africa or to, you know, work at soup kitchens and things like that. Usually I don't do anything about it, but I don't really regard myself as a hero. In fact I think my life is not more exceptional than other people's lives, but because of that fact, if I examine it very closely, then I think other people will be able to identify with their own problems. There used to be this idea of writers that they would go out and they would get this massive amount of experience. They would serve in wars. They would, you know, the Hemingway, Kerouac notion of sort of living life to the fullest and then writing about it. And I think I'm a little too chicken to do that.
Oh, in one of your essays, you write about how when you were young, you kind of defined yourself by your taste in films. You hated Bergman, loved Godard.
Yes.
And that you learned, after experiencing a lot of pain yourself, that real pain didn't have the poetic transcendence of
pain
in film.
Yes.
Yeah. And when you were around 17, you tried suicide.
Yeah.
And you left a suicide note that quoted both Paul Goodman and Freud.
Right.
Who were you expecting to read the note, and why did you quote them? Which parts did you quote?
I think I actually quoted a line saying, from Goodman, saying it's impossible for anyone to imagine his own suicide, in which I was, in a sense, explaining my inability to really, that I didn't really know what I was doing, but I was doing it anyway. And the whole, I think anybody who lives so much in books and films gets a hunger for life to take this kind of form, to take a kind of form of beauty and meaning and lyricism. And at that time, I just felt that there was an enormous distance between the beauty of the world as it was represented in films and books, even when it was a story of intense suffering, and the sort of banal day-to-day nagging pain that I was feeling. And of course, I was also going through, you know, a real adolescent identity crisis, and it's a difficult time for even the most well-balanced person, adolescence. And I think what the rest of my life has been is a search to find form in daily life, so that when I write about it, I keep diaries a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about diaries is that you'll have an experience, you know, you'll go to the dry cleaner and you'll have a little exchange or something like that. And then you'll come home and you'll get on the phone with a friend and you'll start to tell them what had happened. And sometimes as you're telling the anecdote, it will vanish in your hands. You realize that there is no point to the anecdote. And what I did when I kept diaries was I wrote down all kinds of things. And sometimes just in the act of writing them down, they would begin to find a form. So that was what was very satisfying for me, was to work with the materials of daily life until I understood them at least enough so that, to me, they had a kind of shape.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you one other thing about your suicide note.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after you had taken around 20 tranquilizers,
mm-hmm.
threw up,
mm-hmm.
and got shipped off to the hospital where your stomach was pumped, did anyone ever read that note, or did you destroy it first?
That's a really good question. I wonder what happened to that note. I never destroyed it. I had about four roommates. As I write in that particular essay, I had taken all these pills, and earlier I had had a meal at the Columbia dining hall, and Columbia was famous for its terrible institutional food, and they had beef stew, some really terrible beef stew, and then I had drunk a quart of orange juice, Tropicana orange juice, to take the pills with, you know, and then I lay down to die, you know, and the combination of the beef stew and the orange juice and the pills just was not working, you know, and here I thought I was going to sort of like drift off in a bark, you know, it didn't work that way at all, you know. Instead, it was a kind of anti-peristalsis. So I don't know what peristalsis, but anyway, I could not digest the food. And since then, I've had a very hard time drinking Tropicana orange juice. And beef stew is not one of my favorite dishes.
But the note, you don't know if anyone read it or not.
I don't know what happened to the note. I'd be glad to reprint it in my collected works, but... I think this was not my finest moment as a writer, actually.
Did you think when you were trying to take your life that it would be kind of Greta Garbo-ish in its way? You know, that you'd be lying there kind of beautiful and intelligent and tranquil, and instead there you were, like, throwing up?
It's really a kind of a metaphor for the way I write, you know, because there's this messy and then there's the neat. I don't think Greta Garbo was my model. I felt myself to be very,
yeah.
very, very unimportant.
Uh-huh.
If I had only imagined myself Greta Garbo, then I never would have tried to kill myself. But I just felt like a very anonymous kid who I was, you know, there's a lot of rage in any suicide. You know, people, I find even now that whenever I'm angry and I can't release the anger, you know, I start to say, that's it, I can't take anymore, you know. And even, you know, now to occasionally have suicidal thoughts, it's something like a kind of, you know, a little bit of malaria in the bloodstream.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're right, actually, that you think you get morbid energy from the lure of suicide.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of like promising yourself that, I always have this treat that I can I can give myself. It's also a way of sort of turning away from the world, you know, sort of pushing them away.
Well, is the world easier to take knowing that there's always an out, which you really probably won't ever use? But
yes, I think particularly for me, because I'm, to characterize myself, I'm a fairly gregarious and sociable person. And And I have a real extroverted side, and then there's this introverted side which makes its demands and out of which I write. So in order to go inside, I sometimes have to push the world away. This world which has been very nice to me and which has been very friendly to me, I have to kind of, I have to get an edge somehow. So sometimes people are surprised that my work is so mocking or occasionally has flashes of misanthropy, because when they see me in social situations, they don't feel me to be that way at all.
I know what you mean, though, about that combination of extroversion and introversion. Mm-hmm. I think I understand, but that a lot of people are confused by.
Well, how do you?
It seems contradictory.
Well, how do you go from one to the other? For instance, I've taught for many years, and when you teach, you're out there on the line, and you have to make eye contact with all your students, and you have to feel them. You know, like there's one in the corner who thinks she's being completely ignored and is very unhappy. So you have to sort of direct your energy there, and then when it's over, I want to write, you know, so I have to become an entirely different person. And this shifting gears from the introverted to the extroverted and back, it's not without a certain cost, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think writers are people who have a need to be alone with themselves, you know. But not all the time. I think if I were doing that all the time, I would get cabin fever. I love to be in the world, but then I love to, you know, go away from it.
You once wrote that as when you were young, you were a goody-goody, but you were never sure whether it's because you were good or whether you were just too timid or too programmed to do otherwise. What do you think, looking back?
I think I was a bit of a goody-goody. Uh-huh. I remember once, this is an embarrassing thing to admit, but I remember once my mother worked, and a lot of my classmates when I was in the second grade or so, third grade, their mother stayed home, you know, and I would go over to their houses to play, and there would be this mother who would bring her little kid milk and cookies, and it seemed like this really wonderful life to have this mother who was your servant, you know, who was there to bring you treats the moment you came in the door. And a lot of the my friends, they didn't see it that way. They saw it as the mother hovering over them all the time and never giving them any air. But I remember once going over to this kid's house, and his mother brought him milk and cookies, and then he wanted to go out and play, and she asked him to take the garbage out, and he didn't want to take the garbage out. And I said, "I'll do it, Mrs. Weiss, you know." That's pretty goody-goody, don't you think? I wanted all the mothers to love me. But I think that what's underneath that quote is a kind of troubled relation to virtue, you know. It's almost like, and this is a very Dostoevskian idea, that we know that we're acting out of our free will when we do something that's spiteful or something that's malicious or something that's bad for ourselves or bad for others. But do we know that we're acting out of our free will when we do something that's good? And I think in the long run, we are just as much acting out of our free will. But it's just that sort of lingering sense of guilt about being virtuous. Are we virtuous because we really mean it, or because we don't feel we have enough bravery to do something else?
Or we want praise.
Or we want praise, exactly.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Well, thanks for the wonderful interview.
Philip Lopate's book of essays, Against Joie de Vivre, is published by Poseidon Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with UEP Moe. He's known as the godfather of Gulf Coast rock and roll, and he's discovered and produced regional talents such as Freddie Fender, Rockin' Sydney, and the Sir Douglas Quintet. Here's a record he produced by Archie Bell and the Drells.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Architect and writer Witold Rybczynski started out to build a boat shed, but he turned it into a house and moved in. Coming up, Rybczynski reflects on what makes a building a home. Also, we welcome New Orleans pianist Harry Connick Jr. back to our weekly performance spot. And critic at large Laurie Stone reviews World Without End, an autobiographical story of incest by performance artist Holly Hughes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. President Bush arrived in Rome today, the first stop on his four-nation European trip. The White House so far won't confirm a Washington Times report that the president will announce the pullout of as many as 34,000 U.S. troops from Europe during NATO meetings in Brussels. Arriving in Rome, Bush emphasized the importance of the Western alliance, and he expressed his desire to see barriers between the West and Eastern Europe overcome.
We will be actively engaged in Eastern Europe, promoting measures to encourage political and economic liberalization in Poland. The United States welcomes a stronger and more united Europe.
The president plans to visit Poland in July. Bush joins 15 other NATO leaders to celebrate the alliance's 40th anniversary beginning Sunday in Brussels. On the 14th day of the student-led occupation of Beijing's Tiananmen Square, reports from various sources around the capital indicate hardliners have won a power struggle within the government. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports from Beijing.
The government has made no announcement, but people around Beijing are talking about the news that party leader Zhao Ziyang and other liberals have been stripped of their power. According to more than one source, Zhao Ziyang has been placed under house arrest. Other leaders who reportedly are under attack include the nation's defense minister, the vice premier, and a member of the Politburo Standing Committee who's in charge of propaganda. Party leader Zhao Ziyang is one of the government officials who opposed the imposition of martial law against pro-democracy demonstrators. Students occupying Tiananmen Square say they'll remain where they are, despite the reported downfall of liberals within the government. In Beijing, this is Vicky O'Hara.
In Moscow today, the Congress of the People's Deputies wound up the second day of their meeting by electing a sitting legislature from among their members. The legislature, called the Supreme Soviet, will work 8 months out of the year. During today's session, many delegates objected to the election to the Supreme Soviet by progressive deputies who want to see perestroika and democracy move ahead even faster. Czechoslovakia has told four Britons they must leave the country in 14 days. It's the latest move in a tit-for-tat diplomatic battle. Edward Lucas in Prague has the story.
Among those told to go were the two diplomats, both fluent Czech speakers, responsible for contact with dissidents. The others are another embassy official and a businessman. The move follows the expulsion by Britain yesterday of four Czechoslovak diplomats on charges of spying. The authorities here have given few details of their allegations, saying simply the four Britons have engaged in activities incompatible with their status, charges Britain denies. But it's thought that diplomats' human rights work may have been a factor. This round of expulsions follows a similar row earlier this week between Britain and the Soviet Union, which is leading to a sharp reduction in the British presence in Moscow. For National Public Radio, this is Edward Lucas in Prague.
One person remains unaccounted for following yesterday's gasoline pipeline explosion in San Bernardino, California. The blast killed at least three people, injured 31 others, and demolished 10 homes. The National Transportation Safety Board is investigating the explosion, which occurred in an underground pipeline owned by Calnev. A company spokesman says there's a good possibility the gasoline conduit may have been damaged 2 weeks ago when derailed train cars careened into the neighborhood, killing four people. A jury in Columbus today convicted Republican Representative Donald Lukens of Ohio of contributing to the delinquency of a minor for having sex with a teenage girl. The jurors also found that Lukens served the girl an alcoholic drink. Lukens now faces a possible six-month jail sentence and a $1,000 fine. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 11 points to close the week at 2493.77. Advances led declines on volume of 143 million shares. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. About a year ago, pianist and singer Harry Connick Jr. was a relatively unknown newcomer. Today he's one of the most written about young performers on the jazz scene. His second recording, 20, which is how old he was when he was cutting it in the studio, was released a few months ago. For this week's performance segment, we asked Harry to play some songs he hasn't yet recorded.
I was talking to a very great singer, a friend of mine, Marion Cowings, and he was asking me if I had ever heard Jack Jones sing, and I told him that the only recording I knew of was the Love Boat theme. He sounded great on that, but Marion said, well, you have to hear him do Street of Dreams. He was about 25 years old, and I think he'll enjoy it. And I really did. It knocked me out, the fact that I had never really heard him sing, and to hear him sing so magnificently was really a thrill. So this tune is for Jack Jones, The Street of Dreams. Love laughs at a king, 'cause kings don't mean a thing. On the street of dreams, dreams broken in two can be made like new. On the street of dreams, gold, silver, and gold, all that you hold is in the moonbeams. Poor, no one is poor, long as love is sure, on the street of dreams. The street of dreams. Jack Jones, man, he sure did a good job of that tune. But anyway, I saw Jack Jones on the Password game today. And speaking of Password, Cole Porter is the password to this next tune I'm going to play. Cole wrote a great tune called It's All Right With Me. And right now, I would like to do this tune in the style of New Orleans piano playing. This is a great Cole composition entitled It's All Right With Me. Thank you.
pianist and singer Harry Connick Jr. His second album is titled 20. This is Fresh Air. Architect Witold Rybczynski wrote about the meaning of comfort in his book Home, A Short History of an Idea. He says he found that architectural ideals he'd been taught in school frequently contradicted his clients' notions of comfort. Rybczynski experienced the same conflicts when he became his own client and built his own home in an orchard near Quebec. It was a 6-year experience that he describes in his new book, The Most Beautiful House in the World. Rybczynski hadn't set out to build a home. His initial design was for a boat shed. When he started building, he was reminded of how much he was bothered by a line in a now classic architecture text, which said, "A bicycle shed is a building, a cathedral is architecture."
Simple buildings are often very satisfying, and buildings like barns and country buildings built without architects have always interested me. And so I think as soon as I read it, I felt that at least for me, the line should be drawn somewhere else. And this is something I explore in the book.
Well, your building kept changing. You know, it started off as a boat shed. Then it became a boat shed in the shape of a barn. How did it end up in that particular shape?
Well, the place where I was building was extremely exposed. And one of the, I think, issues of any building is how does it fit into its surroundings? In this particular case, one of the reasons that I adopted the barn form, which was useful for building a boat anyway, was the fact that I wanted to make a building that didn't stick out and look strange in the middle of the field. It was quite an exposed location. You could see the building as you approached it. And I realized that most of the buildings that you could see from where I was were, in fact, barns, and that they created what I call a kind of architectural language, and buildings have to talk to each other. If you have a building like the new hotel I've seen recently in San Francisco that is kind of shouting at everybody but not really discussing with them, the buildings start to kind of stick out and feel left out. And even in the country, and especially in the city, buildings are a kind of discussion group, and they say things to one another, and the architect has to be very careful that a new building somehow becomes part of the discussion and not left out of it.
How did the shed become a home?
Well, I think at one point I built the house myself, and I realized that I guess I only had a certain amount of carpentry in me, and I didn't need to build a boat. I'd sort of got it out of my system. And I was, on the other hand, I had this large kind of barn building, and it was, at one point, I sort of was calculating on paper, and I realized that it was actually quite big enough for a house. There was enough volume in it for a house if I converted it, if I changed things around. So I thought, well, instead of kind of abandoning it, why don't I change this over and with a certain amount of changes, I can make it into quite a nice house. And that's really what happened.
You and your wife had different points of view about the size of the bathroom. She wanted it larger than you initially wanted it.
Yes, I talk about that because when you're designing a house, there's a lot of standard things that an architect keeps in his mind. For instance, the size of doors or the size how stairs are designed or the size of a closet. And one of these standard solutions tends to be the bathroom. We an architect knows that a bathroom needs a space about 5 feet by 7 feet, and he draws that in as a kind of box in the house, and then spends more time designing the non-standard spaces, like the living room, for instance. This is good in a way because it makes it easier to work, but it also means that you tend to accept standard solutions and you don't question them. And I think what my wife did was say, well, why does the bathroom have to be this small? Couldn't it be bigger? Couldn't it be laid out in a different way? What she was really saying was that shouldn't the bathroom be designed as a room, the way a living room is, rather than simply taken for granted in a sort of mechanical way.
So how did you design your bathroom, and what size did it end up?
My house is very tiny, I should say. So it started off as a minimal bathroom. It's certainly not a huge bathroom. I'm sure my wife would want it even bigger. I guess it's about 6 feet by 12 feet, something like that. But what I did was I remember seeing a bathroom once, I think it was designed by Le Corbusier, in which the whole bathroom was tiled like a huge shower stall. And instead of having a separate shower area, he just drained the floor, and you could take your shower in this room. So I did the same thing. I tiled the whole room, and one end of it has a sloping floor to a drain, and so you have a shower which is more like the sort of showers that I remember from school or gymnasiums, mm-hmm. where you really have space rather than being stuck in a little cubicle.
No shower curtain even?
No. Of course, if your space is big enough, the water only splashes a certain distance. And so you just have the shower at one end and the rest of the room at the other, and it works quite well.
When the house was done, you thought that it didn't look quite like a house enough on the outside. So what did you do to make it look more like a home?
Well, that's an important point, because one of the beliefs of modern architecture was that if you solve the functional problems, you automatically you got the right kind of building. If it worked, it was beautiful. As a form follows function, which Louis Sullivan said. This is something which I and many people believe is really an oversimplification, that if you design a house and solve all the functional problems, it may still not, for instance, look like a house. And it's very important that a house look like a house. It's not enough that it just be convenient. And one of the things, for instance, that defines a house is the front door. We have to see the front door. It has to welcome us. It has to look like a front door. And in my case, since the house had been originally a workshop, the front door wasn't even visible. And so I had to move things around and try to give a feeling that you weren't living in a barn, but this, in fact, was a house.
You know, to me, the idea of building a home is basically an impossibility. It's so out of the reach of most of us. I guess as an architect, it's different because you can build it. It's probably not all that expensive if you're doing it yourself. I mean, I'm sure it's really expensive, but not like it would cost for a civilian who had to hire all the contractors.
Sure. No, in my case, we did all the work ourselves, and it did it over a long period of time. But I mentioned in the book that building your own home has become a luxury. It's paradoxical that, of course, people in what we call less developed countries by and large do build their own homes, however tiny they may be. And we, with all our wealth, have made this very basic and age-old activity into something of a luxury, which is, I think, a great shame, because it is one of the things which is a wonderful experience, and I think an important experience.
Could you imagine yourself ever moving out of the house that you built into a pre-built home?
That's a problem, because I can't. I've really gotten stuck there. It may at one point wear off, but it is difficult to imagine living anywhere else in any permanent way, because when you create this place around yourself. It's a place which didn't exist before. It exists in your imagination. You create it, and in some very real sense, it's like living inside yourself. So to leave that is to leave something of yourself. So it would require some really extraordinary circumstances, I think, to push me out of this safe place, this safe haven.
Well, enjoy your home, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Vital Rybczynski is a professor of architecture at McGill University in Montreal. His new book, The Most Beautiful House in the World, is published by Viking Press. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is joining us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. We're still watching China, where the situation continues to change, and the People's Congress. We're watching that unfold in the Soviet Union. But to send everybody off for the holiday weekend, we're going to take a look at a brewery, an ancient one, archaeologists have uncovered in Egypt. We're going to hear some of a modern version of a Mozart opera, listen to the advice of a psychologist who says that if we remain mindful, if we pay attention, we're liable to live longer. And then we're going to look into something that really has a summertime sound to it, the perfect egg cream with Daniel Pinkwater.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Mother-daughter relationships have been the subject of endless books, movies, and plays, but a mother-daughter taboo is the inspiration for a new one-woman show by Holly Hughes. Critic at large Laurie Stone saw it recently at Performance Space 122 in New York.
Holly Hughes was hoping to paint when she came to New York in the 70s. While hanging around Alphabet City on the Lower East Side, she became part of the gay theater scene. Next followed a string of plays, The Lady Dick, The Well of Horniness, and Dress Suits to Hire, all written in a hard-boiled, sleaze-loving voice. The pieces were like film noir, told from the perspective of the bad girls. Lesbian sexuality was a given. The heroines weren't victims, but perpetrators of violence and irony. Best of all, Hughes was funny, and her language took surprising poetic flights. Last month, she debuted her latest piece, World Without End, an autobiographical solo performance, and it proved an exciting advance in her art. Front and center are her adventurousness into taboo subjects and the gorgeous rhythms of her language. When the lights come up, Hughes strikes a pose suggestive of a Balthus painting. Her legs are flung over the side of an armchair. A sleeve exposes a shoulder. Her childish bob curtains a face that has never been innocent. Her language soars like skywriting as she maps an intimacy redolent of incest. The pair are mother and daughter, Holly and her mom. Mother-daughter eroticism has been excavated by a candid few. Colette in Reminiscences of Sido, Mona Simpson in Anywhere But Here, Vivian Gornick in Fierce Attachments. Hughes adds her voice and is similarly juiced by the subject. Hughes spent her childhood in Saginaw, Michigan, an area so flat that a mound of landfill loomed magically mountainous. Amid the overall predictability, the lustiness of Holly's mom crackled like a foreign language and filled her daughter's senses.
I sleep in the big bed all by myself. It's dangerous, I know. I could drown. On the other hand, I can really spread out, take up all the space I want, like Africa. On the street in the daytime, people see me and they think, what a small woman, who would be afraid of her? But they haven't been to bed with me, what do they know about fear?
Hughes's performance is by turns macho and kittenish. It resembles those of the high-wire stand-up comedians Sandra Bernhardt and Richard Pryor, soloists who expose their vanity, sexual rage, and solipsism, and thus startle to consciousness all of us veiling similar frailties. Hughes's tabloid sensibility is effective in busting high art pretensions, but, and this is the downside, it's sometimes an end in itself. She doesn't probe her material deeply enough. In the scene where her mother stands nude, the older woman insists that her daughter watch while she excites herself, but this violation is dodged by Holly with cute grimaces. There's another deeply disturbing sequence where Holly's mother slaughters a porcupine, and this is presented as gothic funk. Instead of probing her own abuse, Holly resorts to jokesiness and shock tactics. Too many anecdotes come across as ingredients for the creation of Holly, the adorably bent vixen. But it's only a matter of time before Hughes, who is in her early 30s, taps the emotional center of her narrative. Then she will not only whet our appetites with inventiveness and theatricality, she will tell us things we've never heard.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic, and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Holly Hughes will perform World Without End at Highways in Los Angeles in June. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, prison girls, thrill-crazy delinquents, and the evil influence of rock and roll. Michael Barson tells us about Lost, Lonely, and Vicious, his collection of movie posters from what he calls the great trash films of the 50s. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles High Records, the company that launched the career of Al Green. And television critic David Bianculli reviews the revamped, not necessarily the news, HBO's satirical look at current events. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistance from Ed Doherty. Research assistance from Christopher Cook and Laura Sivitz. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Lisa Bruton and Chris Spurgeon directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.